Malachi, chapter 1 to chapter 2, verse 16. The first talk in a series on Malachi was presented by Gil Greco on September 20th, 2020, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gil Greco. This recording is being made available to you by Gutenberg College, a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. This recording was taken from a talk originally streamed online. Malachi Handout Number 1 accompanies this talk.
Welcome to Online Reformation Fellowship. My name's Gil Greco. I have been teaching a series in Ezra Nehemiah for the past 8 weeks. I agreed to teach for 10 weeks, and it took me 8 weeks to teach Ezra Nehemiah, so I am going to teach the book of Malachi. I love the book of Malachi. For how short it is, it's certainly an important source for the authors of the New Testament. It gets quoted a lot for how short it is. Probably the other book that's comparable is Habakkuk, in that Paul quotes the righteous shall live by faith a bunch throughout his letters. But we'll see passages that I think you'll find familiar. And I think this book really captures a particular way of looking at the world, of how God is working in the world and history, that I think is really important. I think that Malachi is a drawstring prophecy. Let me explain what I mean by a drawstring prophecy. Famously, Martin Luther called the Epistle of James an epistle of straw. He believed that the things that James was saying were out of step with what Paul says in the rest of the New Testament. I'm sure part of his reasoning for that is because when you first read James, James seems to just hop from one topic to the next, and he doesn't spell out the connection between things as he goes along. And there isn't an apparent logic to what he's doing. One of the most memorable discussions I ever had at Gutenberg was about the Epistle of James. By memorable, I don't mean that I remember exactly what was said, but I do remember this great dynamic to how the discussion felt. I remember that I went in convinced that whatever James was saying, it was coherent. And there were some other people in the discussion who came in who felt that he was sort of jumping around. But as we went on through the discussion, we all started to piece together how each new thing that James introduced was actually an extremely relevant piece to what James wanted to talk about. So near the end, we were just reading through each section going, oh, and that connects to this general idea because, and then we'd read the next section and everyone was involved and everyone could see the logic of what was going on, and it was great. So since that discussion, I've thought of James as a drawstring epistle contra Luther, because the more you look at James, the more it pulls together into a thematic whole. Similarly, I think that Malachi is a drawstring prophecy. The more I study this book, the more it seems like the entire work is focused on only a handful of themes and issues, despite how unconnected it feels sort of when you first start reading it. Rather than laying out all the themes and issues at the outset, however, I'm going to work through the book section by section, and hopefully by doing that, you will start to see how all of these ideas are connected. If you don't sort of experience that drawstring, I will try to pull it all together as we get into the end. One last sort of preliminary thing I want to talk about before we actually get into the text is, when was this book written? We have a couple of clues to give us a relative chronology. We know that a lot of discussion in the book is about temple offerings and sacrifices. There are also several loan words from other languages that would not have been in use during the first temple. So if you have temple, you know, temple language, and then you have loanwords that couldn't have been during the first temple, it must have been written during the second temple. The book also seems to be referencing an incident where Edom is being torn down by invaders, which most scholars think are the Nabataeans. The Nabataeans are a group of folks who, I think they're probably most famous for building Petra, which is that city that's just carved out of rock. And apparently they came through and defeated Edom. The dates for that invasion are somewhat imprecise, and so the dates for when Malachi could have had its sort of starting point are equally imprecise. Besides those factors, there's a lot of disagreement about when this took place. During our series through Ezra and Nehemiah, I pointed out that one commentator, whose name is J.M.P. Smith, argues that the situation in Malachi fits the situation in which Nehemiah worked as snugly as a bone fits its socket. So a lot of the sins that Malachi will take issue with mirror sins that Nehemiah confronts. I think this is probably a safe assumption that it probably took place at this time, with the only caveat being that the sins in Malachi, or at least the root of the sins that show up in Malachi, are so universal and so ubiquitous throughout Israel's history that I would not be surprised if it turns out that Malachi was written at some other time after the Second Temple and the fall of Edom. Before we get into the text, if any of you are using the handout that I made, I am not going to stick to paragraphs in the same way that I did in Ezra Nehemiah. My paragraphs reflect what I think of as the rhetorical units throughout the book. And I think that there's a lot more to explain than just to read the whole rhetorical unit. So I'm going to kind of go sentence by sentence in some cases, or idea by idea, and talk about those. Even though I think I have done a pretty good job in showing you where sort of the breaks in thought or the new topics sort of come up by my paragraphing. Okay, so let's get started in the book of Malachi. So in the NASB, this is 1:1, the oracle of the word of Yahweh to Israel through Malachi. So this superscription tells us about the prophet, the origin of his prophecy, and his audience. The prophet is Malachi. This name is built from malak, which is the root word, which seems roughly equivalent in usage to the word angelos in Greek, which can mean messenger or angel. The Malachi suffix at the end is a possessive suffix, meaning that the name literally means my messenger or my angel. Now, the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, literally renders it his messenger, presumably to not have a weird third person to first person shift. So instead of having the oracle of the word of Yahweh to Israel through my messenger, it has the oracle of the word of Yahweh to Israel through his messenger. There are several suggestions for who Malachi is. And the first main suggestion follows the Septuagint in that it assumes that Malachi is not a name at all, but it's just an indication that there is an anonymous prophet who is delivering this oracle. This first main suggestion is favored in general by modern scholars. The suggestion is bolstered by the fact that Zechariah has a few places where this formula, the oracle of the word of Yahweh to Israel, appears. And modern scholars take it to be an anonymous prophecy in Zechariah. Those places where it appears in Zechariah, they take those to be anonymous prophecies that got added to the book of Zechariah before Zechariah was canonized. Furthermore, some modern scholars will argue that the name Malachi would be an inappropriate name for a child, and there's no evidence for such a name elsewhere in the Old Testament. The second main suggestion, which follows the Jewish tradition, says that Malachi is not an indicator of anonymity, but rather a title. In the Targums, which the word Targum literally means translation, and often refers to the Aramaic versions of the Old Testament, there seem to be indications that Malachi was a title for Ezra the scribe. They have added whose name is called Ezra the scribe. This is also true of the Talmud, which is the collection of writings which comprise most of the teaching of Jewish rabbinical tradition. In the Christian tradition, this view was also espoused by Jerome, who famously made the ubiquitous Latin translation of the Bible called the Vulgate, and John Calvin, who was one of the main leaders of the Protestant Reformation. The final suggestion, adopted by most modern conservative scholars, so I'll say most conservative scholars nowadays, to not confuse you with modern scholars, is that Malachi is the prophet's actual name. Conservatives usually echo Baldwin, who is a commentator, who in her commentary on Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi dismisses the primary reasons with which modern scholars argue Malachi cannot be a name. And I'm going to quote her here. Quote, so these are the primary reasons that they say that Malachi can't be a name. Quote, the fact that it, that is his name, is not found elsewhere in the Old Testament, she points out, but neither is Habakkuk. The absence of any precise description of him, such as the son of or the prophet, but the same is true of Obadiah. The fact that in Zechariah 9:1 and 12:1, oracle of the word of the Lord has been commonly interpreted as a mark of anonymity. This is Baldwin again. If, however, as has been argued in this commentary, the last six chapters of Zechariah are an integral part of his book and not anonymous, this argument falls to the ground. So Baldwin, having thus removed obstacles to the contrary, and Jewish tradition being inconclusive, conservative scholars will surmise that Malachi is the actual name of the prophet. So I will mostly, for the sake of ease, assume the third suggestion to be true, as it makes talking about the author easiest. I would not be disappointed if, in the future, it turns out that Malachi was a title for Ezra. I'll refer to the author of this prophecy as Malachi, instead of talking about the editor or the author or whatever word salad I use to talk about whoever wrote Ezra. Okay. We are told that the oracle, which literally means a carried thing or a burden, consists of Yahweh's word to Israel. Yahweh is, of course, the proper name of the creator of heaven and earth, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the one whom Jesus called Father. This is the Yahweh. This Yahweh is the origin of the prophecy. You will notice that I have amended the NASB to read Yahweh everywhere that a real Bible would say Lord in small caps, because conventionally that's how English texts render the underlying Hebrew Yahweh. So I've just switched it back so that we get a sense of where his proper name is used. In any case, Yahweh has something to say to Israel, which I think throughout this work refers to the ethnic, geographic people of the returned exiles. I think that Israel, in that sense, is the same Israel that Paul is referring to when he says, not all Israel is true Israel. The all Israel is, of all of the people who make up this ethnic geographic people, not all of them are true Israel. So I think throughout Malachi, Israel is going to be used to denote the larger group, the one that includes all of the people who live in the land and who have come back from the exile. All right. So this is 1, 2 through 5 in your regular Bibles. I have loved you, says Yahweh, but you say, how have you loved us? Was not Esau Jacob's brother, declares Yahweh? Yet I have loved Jacob, but I have hated Esau, and I have made his mountains a desolation and appointed his inheritance for the jackals of the wilderness. Though Edom says, we have been beaten down, but we will return and build up the ruins. Thus says Yahweh of hosts, they may build, but I will tear down. And men will call them the wicked territory and the people toward whom Yahweh is indignant forever. Your eyes will see this, and you will say, Yahweh be magnified beyond the border of Israel. So the actual message or prophecy begins with Yahweh telling Israel that he has loved them. Throughout Malachi, we will see that the message has been delivered as a dialogue between Israel and Yahweh, often with Israel being skeptical or cynical about the claims that Yahweh makes. I believe that we to envision this almost like a stage play with a Greek chorus, if you will, that's made up of Israelites and a single actor playing Yahweh. So sort of keep this in mind as we move forward. These sort of dialogues are going to be very common, and I think we're sort of mentally, I don't know that we're supposed to sort of mentally picture this, like it's not supposed to be produced like a play, but I think that's the sort of dynamic that's going on, which will become important later for a few key passages where remembering that setup is going to help us interpret what's going on. So this first exchange clarifies in what sense Yahweh has loved Israel. He loved Jacob, but hated Esau, who you remember are the twin sons of Isaac. Yahweh points out what I assume is the recent destruction of Edom by the Nabataeans as evidence that Yahweh hates Edom, who are Esau's descendants, but loves Jacob. There is an obvious trouble with this evidence, however, because Israel has only recently recovered from their own destruction and exile at the hands of the Babylonians. A cynic might think that perhaps a people being conquered and rebuilding is just part of the cycle of history. Edom has been destroyed and exiled, but who is to say that they cannot rebuild? Anticipating the cynical response, Yahweh prophesies, though Edom says, we have been beaten down, but we will return and build up the ruins. Thus says Yahweh of hosts, they may build, but I will tear down, and men will call them the wicked territory and the people toward whom Yahweh is indignant forever. In other words, the end of history will show that Edom has not been chosen by God. Though the processes of history may lead to Edom being rebuilt, in the final analysis, history will show that God loved Jacob and hated Esau. Furthermore, this prophecy will be so obvious that Israel will see that Yahweh has power outside of Israel. An implication of this prophecy is that Jacob will therefore be revealed as the, say the opposite of what he said about them, the wicked territory, then they would be the blessed territory. And if Edom is the people toward whom Yahweh is indignant forever, then Jacob would be the people who Yahweh loves forever. Jacob, then, is the true Israel. And I maintain, and I'm going to maintain as I talk about Malachi, that Malachi uses Jacob in this way throughout his prophecy, that Jacob is the true Israel that Paul would refer to as the true Israel. So this first dialogue demonstrates a logical structure that's going to underlie most of what we read in the rest of Malachi. Yahweh is going to make some kind of claim. Israel's going to respond, usually in a cynical or skeptical manner. Yahweh will spell out how the claim he is making is the case. And he will conclude that things are going to change, or that things ought to change, by talking about how history will end up resolving itself. In the end, everything will be apparent the way that Yahweh says it will be. And as I say, I'm going to try to point this out as we go along through the text. Okay, paragraph 3. A son honors his father and a servant his master. Then if I am a father, where is my honor? And if I am a master, where is my respect? Says Yahweh of hosts, to you, O priests, who despise my name. But you say, Have we despised your name? You are presenting defiled food upon my altar. But you say, how have we defiled you? In that you say, the table of Yahweh is to be despised. But when you present the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? And when you present the lame and sick, is it not evil? Why not offer it to your governor? Would he be pleased with you? Or would he receive you kindly? Says Yahweh of hosts. So Yahweh is now laying down two analogies to his relationship with Israel. One between a father and a son, and another between a servant and his master. Both of these relationships entail certain kinds of obligations. A son honors his father, and a slave respects his master. Yahweh then asks where the honor due him as a father and a master are, and specifically addresses this to a particular segment of Israel, the priests, who Yahweh claims despise his name. The priest's response is, how have we despised your name? Yahweh contends that they have presented defiled food upon his altar. Again, they respond, how have we defiled you? Yahweh says that they say that the table of Yahweh is to be despised. We're going to see as we continue to go through Malachi that the things that get said are not necessarily things that people are saying out loud. These are things that if you could crystallize the attitudes that people have that we know through the actions they're taking, these are what they would say if you could get people to be so honest that what they said and what they do are integrated sort of in a perfect way. So the things that the priests are saying here are not literally the things that they're saying. No one's going around going, the table of Yahweh is to be despised. Rather, what Yahweh is contending is that by their actions, they are showing that that's what they really think about the table of Yahweh, that it is to be despised. And then he will lay out what are the actions that they are taking that show that this is the case. So, what are the actions they're taking that show that this is the case? Yahweh points out that they have presented blinded, lame, and sick animals for sacrifice. This is evil, on the one hand, because the Torah commands priests to only present blemish-free animals for the sacrifice. On the other hand, the quality of the animal is such that they would not feel comfortable presenting these animals as food to a secular governor. So this word we have here, governor, is one of those loan words that we get from the Babylonian exile. It's refers to someone in the Babylonian administration. He would not be pleased with such a meal. That's how poor these animals are. Yahweh goes on, but now will you not entreat God's favor that he may be gracious to us? With such an offering on your part, will he receive any of you kindly? Says Yahweh of hosts. Oh, that there were one among you who would shut the gates, that you might not uselessly kindle fire on my altar. I am not pleased with you, says Yahweh of hosts, nor will I accept an offering from you. So, in the previous section, we saw that the kind of animals they're offering, which wouldn't pass muster for what is required of the Torah, and wouldn't pass muster if they were trying to serve it to a secular guest, they want to take those kinds of offerings, the blinded or the lame or the sick animals, and they want to present those to Yahweh as if those are going to be sufficient for his offerings. They want to ask Yahweh for favors and blessings, even though they would never present this food to a human being. I think in emphasis, Yahweh is given the appellation Yahweh of hosts. Now, this has appeared a couple of times in Malachi before, but I want to draw attention to it now because I feel that the of hosts is particularly strong right here. This is a phrase that pops up from time to time in the Old Testament. It is particularly ubiquitous in Malachi. In English, we usually think that the hosts that are in question are the droves of angelic armies that Yahweh has at his disposal which Jesus told Peter that he could call at any moment when Peter cut off that guy's ear. But it's important to remember that throughout the Old Testament, Yahweh also constantly claims to bring about everything in history, such that his hosts would not only include those angels, but it would also include the armies of Cyrus, of Alexander, of the Caesars, and of the Mongols. Never has any man administered war the way that Yahweh does. So, to get a sense of the import of this title, I would render this title as Yahweh, Destroyer of Worlds. Grandiosity and melodrama aside, I think this captures the kind of weight that this title should have, especially in our age of Marvel movies where a villain can wipe out half of existence with a snap of his fingers. I will not just keep saying Destroyer of Worlds as I go through the text, because it does get kind of cloying after a while. But I think that that does capture a little bit some of the sense of this title. So, the disdain that these inferior offerings, the disdain of the priests that these inferior offerings betray, is so offensive to Yahweh that he would even prefer for someone to shut the gates of the temple so that they could not even offer any sacrifices. This is a sentiment that Isaiah and Jesus both talk about. To summarize everything that gets said here, Yahweh says that he is displeased with the priests and that he will not accept their offerings. So, we've seen Yahweh's claim that they are defiling his table. We've seen Israel's response, and particularly the priest's response, because that's specifically who he's addressing. And then we've seen Yahweh lay out what it is that they're doing that backs up what he's claiming. So here, we're going to see what the result will be in the end. For from the rising of the sun, even to its setting, my name will be great among the nations, and in every place incense is going to be offered to my name, and a grain offering that is pure, for my name will be great among the nations, says Yahweh of hosts. So, in the end, incense and a grain offering will be offered to Yahweh's name. This is potentially confusing because Yahweh was just talking about animal sacrifices. My understanding of the Hebrew, and again, here I am dependent on commentators because I don't speak Hebrew. I said at the beginning of my series on Ezra and Nehemiah that one of my weaknesses is not understanding Hebrew. So take this for what it's worth. Apparently, the words which get translated as incense and a grain offering are in the NASB. Are part of a convoluted set of participles. For those of you who don't know fancy grammar terms, what that means is that literally the words in the Hebrew say something like the to be smoked thing instead of incense. We take to be smoked thing and we get incense, and the to be offered thing for a grain offering. So these participles are apparently related to the words from which we get incense and a grain offering in the Torah. But apparently, Malachi is using this weird construction to imply in a sort of punning way, that the thing to be burned and the thing to be offered will be the nations of the world themselves. So he doesn't just say incense and grain will be burned. He said there will be a to-be-offered thing and a to-be-burned thing. And in that context, he's talking about the nations. Furthermore, if this is the case, the nations are going to offer themselves in every place from the rising to the setting of the sun. The logic of Yahweh's claim then goes something like this. I don't need your paltry little offerings from the temple in Jerusalem, Israel. If you knew the history of the future, you would know that in the end, every nation everywhere will offer their entire selves to me. You think your lame, sick, and blind animals will pass muster? You think your leftovers, your trash, holds a candle against this great multitude, which no man can number, of all nations and kindreds and people and tongues? So Yahweh's curse, his displeasure with the Levites, is that they think that this trash that they're offering is enough for Yahweh, when in the end of things, everyone everywhere will worship Yahweh. All right, next section. This is 112 in the NASB and following. But you are profaning it, in that you say, the table of Yahweh is defiled, and as for its fruit, its food is to be despised. You also say, my, how tiresome it is. And you disdainfully sniff at it, says Yahweh of hosts, and you bring what was taken by robbery and what is lame or sick. So you bring the offering. Should I receive that from your hand, says Yahweh? But cursed be the swindler who has a male in his flock and vows it, but sacrifices a blemished animal to Yahweh. For I am a great king, says Yahweh of hosts, and my name is feared among the nations. So we seem to have more of the same sin in this section. The only additional thing that is included in this section, which we did not hear about in the previous section, is that the offerings are taken by robbery. And that's how the New American Standard renders it. The underlying word for taken by robbery is apparently a word that means something like plucked or torn away. And it often gets rendered throughout the Old Testament as stolen. But I think in context, it makes sense for this word not to mean by taken by robbery, which makes it sound like the offerers are the ones who are stealing the animal, but rather that the plucking or the taking, the tearing away, is being done by wild animals. In other words, Yahweh is outraged that what is being offered is essentially roadkill. Though this offering of roadkill is the only new detail, I think that Yahweh has now turned to the whole of Israel instead of just the priests. Why would I think this? First, the people in view are represented as saying the table is defiled and the food is despised. Furthermore, they contend that the table is tiresome. All of these sentiments are similar to what the priest said above. Now, this redundancy could be for emphasis, but I think that given a couple of other things that I will say about this section in a little bit, he's actually making a new, though similar, complaint about Israel as a whole. So, beside the possible redundancy, we have Yahweh's curse. But cursed be the swindler who has a male in his flock and vows it, but sacrifices a blemished animal to Yahweh, for I am a great king. In other words, the audience Yahweh has in view are people who vow a male, but then offer a blemished animal. Offering an animal as part of a vow was something that every person in Israel could do. Note also that Yahweh directly addresses the priests in the next section. So what I take to be happening is that Yahweh pauses in his discussion to the priests. So if we're thinking about our stage play and we have the chorus over here on the one side and Yahweh on the other side, when he calls out the priests, you could have them sort of off to one side, like the sopranos or the tenors or something, with distinctive clothes, and you have him turn very specifically to that group and talk to them, and they might even step out from the group a little bit to mark them off. But then he turns and he says, and you, this section starts, but you are profaning it in that you say, and then he goes on. So I think that you, which is often taken by commentators to be one of emphasis toward the priests, I think he's actually turning aside from the priests to the rest of the people and saying, but you guys are also doing the same thing when you do this. The general population is apparently also bringing in sufficient offerings when they make vows, just as the priests are bringing insufficient offerings when they are making their daily sacrifices. So, having addressed this similar sin to a different audience, Yahweh turns back to the priests. And now, this commandment is for you, O priests. If you do not listen, and if you do not take it to heart to give honor to my name, says Yahweh of hosts, then I will send the curse upon you, and I will curse your blessings. And indeed, I have cursed them already, because you are not taking it to heart. Behold, I am going to rebuke your offspring. Now, the NESB is going to keep going with an and that makes it feel like it's a sentence, but I think it's a separate thought, so we'll go from here. So, Yahweh turns to the priests and tells them that it is their responsibility to pass on this commandment. Now, the way that the NASB makes it sound, it seems like Yahweh is about to give them a commandment that they need to take to heart and listen and so on. But if that's the case, he never spells out what the commandment is. The word is mitzvah, which can mean the body of commandments that Yahweh has given. So I think what Yahweh is saying here is not that he has a commandment for them to do, but rather that they have a commandment that they need to deliver to the people. So yes, in a way, he is commanding them to deliver the commandment, but the commandment he has in view in this verse is not what he's ordering them to do, but rather it is the thing that they are supposed to pass on. The idea that the priests are supposed to deliver Yahweh's commandments is strengthened by the connection which the next couple of phrases make to the famous language of Deuteronomy. He says that if they do not listen or take it to heart, Yahweh will curse their blessings. And indeed, he's already cursed their blessings. Just like how Yahweh would bless or curse the people in Deuteronomy. It's like he's saying, you know the blessings and curses you're supposed to pass on? Well, if you don't pass them on, you'll get the curses. The connection to Deuteronomy is further strengthened by God saying he will rebuke their offspring. I think the sense of this word that gets rendered rebuke is to say that something should not be done, or to command that something not be done anymore. A good equivalent might be prohibit, but prohibit doesn't have this sense that something has been going on till now and we're going to stop it. And that's really the sense I think that rebuke has throughout the Old Testament. It's one of the sort of main meanings of that word, and I think that's important here. If you recall, one of the curses in Deuteronomy is the fruit of your womb will be cursed, and the crops of your land, and the calves of your herds, and the lambs of your flocks. Presumably, those will all be cursed too. One assumes this curse would then be manifested as barrenness of womb and crops and herds and flocks. So the way that you're going to be cursed is that those things that are supposed to produce this abundance don't end up producing. So what Yahweh is saying when he says that he will rebuke their offspring is that he will command their offspring to be something that will not be done anymore. Sort of put it in a very literal phrase. In other words, he's going to stop them from having offspring, whether that be in womb or crop or animals. Those are going to stop happening. And in fact, he says that he's already done this. Yahweh is also going to curse them by spreading refuse on your faces, the refuse of your feasts, and you'll be taken away with it. I used to think that this was like a very dramatic scene from a movie where you start in and you're very close on a person's face and sort of like as you pan out, it's sort of twisting so that you see their face, you know, kind of there. And then you realize that that face is sort of in a heap of trash and that they're dead. They're not just staring at the sky or something, that they're dead and they're in this pile of trash, and that they're going to be carted off. But when I realized that there was this connection to Deuteronomy, that the language of blessing and cursing is very on purpose and is very much trying to connect what he's saying to the priests here to the blessings and curses from Deuteronomy, that made me realize that he is alluding to a specific incident in the history of Israel, which is the incident of the quail coming in the wilderness. I'm going to read a few portions of Numbers that tell this story. This is from Numbers 11. I don't have other indications for the verses. The rabble who were among them had greedy desires, and also the sons of Israel wept again and said, "Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we used to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. But now our appetite is gone. There is nothing at all to look at except this manna." So Moses is very disheartened by this complaint, and he pleads with Yahweh that he points out that Moses is not sufficient to take care of the people by himself. Yahweh responds that he will help Moses with a plan to take care of the people. It involves gathering 70 elders. We're not so concerned with that part. But he does respond, and I'm going to read this section, to the complaint that the people have about the food. "Say to the people, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the ears of the Lord, saying, 'Oh, that someone would give us meat to eat, for we were well off in Egypt.' Therefore the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. You shall eat not one day, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, nor 10 days, nor 20 days, but a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you and have wept before him, saying, 'Why did we ever leave Egypt?'" So, after Moses does all that Yahweh asks, we are told to conclude this specific thread of the story of the people's complaint about eating food. "Now there went forth a wind from the Lord, and it brought quail from the sea, and let them fall beside the camp, about a day's journey on this side, and a day's journey on the other side, all around the camp, and about 2 cubits deep on the surface of the ground. The people spent all day, and all night, and all the next day, and gathered the quail. He who gathered least gathered 10 homers, and they spread them out for themselves all around the camp. While the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people, and the Lord struck the people with a very severe plague." Now, the text doesn't say that this plague made the quail come out of their nostrils. I have heard people talk about this incident as if this is what the plague was. I think it makes a lot of sense to talk about this story as the incident where people were punished by vomiting quail out of their nostrils. The sort of imagery of them deserving to be so stuffed with this that it becomes loathsome to them. Now, God says they're going to eat meat for so long that they're going to hate it, which I think is different from the plague that he brings on them. But I think in history, sometimes we have these particular images that which tell us something about the incident, even though it didn't literally happen. So, for instance, there doesn't seem to be a lot of historical evidence that Luther actually nailed his 95 thesis onto the Wittenberg door. He sent out his 95 thesis. He was trying to get a debate with Tetzel, who was this guy who was selling indulgences throughout Germany. But that picture of him nailing the theses to the door, it evokes this kind of defiance that's so characteristic of Luther that we talk about Luther nailing his theses, you know. And I think that picture fits with what happens in this incident, even if the plague wasn't literally them vomiting stuff out of their nostrils. I hope that's clear to everybody. I'm not trying to interpret what the passage in Numbers is saying. I'm trying to characterize how people have riffed off of that incident. How do you talk about the incident of eating the quail? They stuff themselves so full. The attitude of, we want those cucumbers and fish from Egypt back from when we were slaves. That kind of attitude, that kind of ingratitude to God is such that they deserve to have quail come out of their nostrils. So I don't think that, I mean, I would not be surprised if in the end that's what the plague was, right? If they're, while it's between their teeth, they suddenly start vomiting and it comes out of their nostrils and you have a quite literal picture of them vomiting the quail up. But I think sometimes we talk about this incident as the sort of moral of the story is, if you are greedy and want those cucumbers and fish from Egypt, then you will vomit the quail out of your nostrils. All right, I've said that those words enough. So to get back to Malachi, what Yahweh is saying is, just in the same way that the rabble in Numbers had the refuse of the quail, of the trash on their faces, so the priests are going to vomit their feasts in such a way that refuse will be on their faces and they will be discarded like the trash that's on their faces. Okay, so I think that this whole section, that this particular curse that Yahweh is proclaiming on the priests, he's saying, you guys have the same kind of ingratitude or the same relationship to how you think it works between you and I as your ancestors in Numbers had, and the result is going to be the same. If we're going to sort of take it out of the language of metaphors and allusions, I think that's what he's essentially saying. The people, the rabble in Numbers had a particular attitude and they deserve to be destroyed for it, and you share that same attitude with them and you will be destroyed for it. Okay, Yahweh concludes, and this is apocalyptic or eschatological, I think, having to do with eschatology. Yahweh concludes, then you will know that I have sent this commandment to you, that my covenant may continue with Levi, says Yahweh of hosts. Okay, so notice that we have that same format that we've been seeing throughout these different, what I've been calling dialogues as we've been going through Malachi. Yahweh here has a clincher that is a prophecy that he's going to foretell in the future. Or he's foretelling what will happen in the future. When you reach the final judgment, you will know that I was the one who gave this commandment. There's this phrase, that my covenant may continue with Levi. It's a bit problematic. I'm going to talk about what the covenant with Levi is in the next section, because he will talk about it more. I don't actually think that the covenant with Levi is that confusing. The trouble is with what that means. So the phrase, that my covenant may continue with Levi, I'm not sure what that is doing. My take on how this whole section should be taken is very different from what most commentators think. So most commentators are not asking the same questions of the text that I am. And because I'm reliant on the commentators for understanding Hebrew, their commentary on this phrase is not helpful, because they don't understand that is not connected to the rest of the paragraph in an obvious way. Apparently in Hebrew, there isn't even a word for that. You just have to sort of pull the implication of the that from the other words in the sentence. If somebody knows Hebrew and can help me out here, I would greatly appreciate it. The best I can do for the logic of this phrase is something like this. The covenant of Levi will not be invalidated by your faithlessness to that covenant, because in the end, you will know that the covenant with Levi, like the commandment that I gave you to give to the people, was established by me, Yahweh. So again, if you know Hebrew and can sort of help me out with figuring that out, I would greatly appreciate that. But I think the sense of it is clear, right? I established this commandment. I established the covenant with Levi. you guys not valuing either is not going to be an impediment to me validating both of those things as my work. Okay, so what is the covenant with Levi? He's going to give us some more information in the next section, so I'm going to read that. My covenant with him, that is Levi, was one of life and peace, and I gave them to him as an object of reverence. So he revered me and stood in awe of my name. True instruction was in his mouth, and unrighteousness was not found on his lips. He walked with me in peace and uprightness, and he turned many back from iniquity. So we see that the covenant of Levi was characterized by a number of things. First, Levi's covenant was one of life and peace. Second, the covenant was to be an object of reverence. Third, Levi, in quotes, revered Yahweh and stood in awe of Yahweh's name. Fourth, very in keeping with the Hebrew poetical convention to have two lines that comment on each other, Levi had true instruction in his mouth, but he had no unrighteousness on his lips. So those two parallel each other. Levi walked fifth, Levi walked with Yahweh in peace and uprightness. And sixth, Levi turned many back from iniquity. Because we have no evidence that this was true of Levi, Jacob's son, I think that Malachi is using Levi as an emblem for the son of Levi who most closely embodies all of these qualities, namely Moses. Just in the same way that the Hebrews are often called Israel, or the Edomites are called Esau, I think here Levi stands not for the person, Levi, son of Jacob, but for the group of people whom God has picked out for a particular purpose. If we remember the story of Genesis, there isn't really anything Levi does that would make us believe that the priesthood should come from him. In fact, most of the things we hear about Levi would lead us to think just the opposite. Nevertheless, the descendants of Levi are picked out for special purposes throughout Israel's history. Many of them are picked to serve with regard to the temple. A few of them are picked to serve within the temple itself. And one of them is picked to speak with God face to face. Moses was prepared for the role of being this, the one who speaks to God face to face, so that he acted appropriately as the mediator of God's covenant with Israel. Let me read a little bit further. For the lips of a priest should preserve knowledge, and men should seek instruction from his mouth, for he is the messenger of Yahweh of hosts. So, like Moses, the priests should have the same reverence for Yahweh's, I keep saying mitzvah, but I believe it's technically mitzvot, that would be the plural of commandments. So, Moses had a reverence for God's commandments that the priests should also have. If they had that kind of reverence, then they would be looked to as wise people that men would want to come to for advice, that they would want to hear what God has to say, and the priests would be able to faithfully communicate that because they have the wisdom of God, not their own wisdom. These priests, however, do not have that same reverence. 2:8-9. But as for you, you have turned aside from the way. You have caused many to stumble by the instruction. You have corrupted the covenant of Levi, says Yahweh of hosts. So I also have made you despised and abased before all the people, just as you are not keeping my ways, but are showing partiality in the instruction. So, unfortunately, the current crop of priests do not share with Moses the reverence that he had for the law. They have turned aside in the way, an image which is connected very nearly with the idea of following the path the word of God makes possible. You'll recall Psalms that talk about thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. There are other psalms that talk about God making a straight way or a sure way. The idea is ubiquitous in the Psalms and Proverbs. And the idea is that if you pay attention to what God has commanded, then you will prosper, that you will thrive, that you will be able to go down the path without stumbling. The priests, however, have made people stumble by the instruction. So I think the instruction here, we're still talking about this idea of mitzvah or Torah, right? The Torah that you guys preach, the mitzvah that you guys preach, that you guys are giving to people, is not God's Torah or mitzvah. And so rather than leading them to life, leading down a path that leads to life, you are leading them to stumble. Ultimately, this means that the priests of Malachi's day have corrupted the covenant of Levi. They have not taken the commandment, the mitzvot, seriously in the way that Moses did. Because of this, they have become despised and abased by the people. Now remember, in the previous section, Malachi observed that the wisdom of God makes it so someone who shares that wisdom is sought out as someone men would want to hear from. The contrary of this would then be that someone who shares their own wisdom is clearly only spouting the best that they can come up with. It's obvious to everyone that this sort of person is just making stuff up. Furthermore, this phrase, you are showing partiality in the instruction, this phrase showing partiality literally means carrying a facade, which is not the origin or related sort of linguistically, as far as I can tell, to the Greek word hypokrites, which means actors. Carrying a facade was something that Greek actors did. So it's very interesting that this idea that Jesus has that the Pharisees are actors is resonant in some way or harmonious in some way with this idea that the priests of Malachi's day are the sort of people who carry facades. To top off this little section, there is a repetition here that is, I think, being used of strong effect. Again, I don't speak Hebrew, but it's very striking that the word for partiality or facade that I was just talking about is the same word for face, which just a couple of verses ago, Yahweh just said he would cover with refuse. So it's like Yahweh saying, if you want to deface my commandments, I will deface you. All right. So much for Yahweh's address to the priests. Because they have not had the same reverence for Yahweh that Moses had, they are being exposed as the charlatans they are. They are being exposed as mere men who are making it up as they go along. And because of this, it is obvious to everyone around them that they are not transmitting the wisdom of God, but their own sort of wisdom, which isn't worth very much. Yahweh is now going to turn his attention back to Israel. This is 2:10. Do we not all have one Father? Has not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously each against his brother so as to profane the covenant of our fathers? This analogy uses similar terms to the analogy we saw above, with fathers and sons and so on. But instead of talking about the honor that a son owes a father, it's addressing the loyalty that brothers owe each other on account of their shared heritage, on account of their shared father. He goes on to spell out what this treachery actually consists in. Judah has dealt treacherously, and an abomination has been committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. For Judah has profaned the sanctuary of Yahweh, which he loves, and has married the daughter of a foreign god. The way the punctuation is rendered there is somewhat confusing. I think that the sanctuary is the sanctuary that Yahweh loves. Okay, so it's his sanctuary, and it's the one that he loves. Judah has profaned the sanctuary, which is both God's and is the sanctuary that God loves. Something like that. And how has he done this? He has done this by marrying the daughter of a foreign god. So Judah, which I think in this case is just like what I said above about Israel. It's just the people of this geographic and ethnic group has been treacherous by profaning the sanctuary of Yahweh and by marrying the daughter of a foreign god. And in fact, the way that he has profaned the sanctuary of Yahweh, I contend, is by marrying the daughter of a foreign god. This profaning of the sanctuary and marrying of this daughter of a foreign god is called an abomination. As we saw back in Ezra Nehemiah, not all of Moab is true Moab. What the prophets and what the Old Testament has in view when it is warning people against marrying foreigners is not that there's some kind of ethnic purity that has to be the case in order for Israel to be what it is, but rather that there needs to be a purity of faith or a purity of religion, you could even say, in order for Israel to be what it is. Marrying a foreign woman, or marrying, as it says here, the daughter of a foreign god, is problematic not because of where she's from, but because of what she believes. Women, as I argued in Ezra Nehemiah, pass on the culture and religion of whatever country they are from. So Moabitesses are problematic because they believe in the religion and culture of Moab. This is why Ruth is an exception, because when she comes out of Moab with Naomi, she says, "Your people will be my people and your God my God." So, as I've been saying, not all Moab is true Moab. But here, when we're talking about an Israelite marrying a foreign woman, we are talking about this sort of religious idea, which is the problem with marrying foreign women. These women that the Israelites are marrying are passing on this culture, and this is emphasized by the fact that they are called the daughter of a foreign god, the daughters of a foreign god. So this is why it says that Judah has profaned the sanctuary that Yahweh loves. The sanctuary is a synecdoche. It's standing in for all of the religious practices that God gave to the children of Israel. Judah is profaning those practices because by marrying this daughter of a foreign god, he has taken on a religion that is not part of the religion that Yahweh instituted. It goes on, "As for the man who does this, may Yahweh cut off from the tents of Jacob everyone who awakes and answers and who presents an offering to Yahweh of hosts." So in response to this abomination, Malachi asks that Yahweh cut off this man from the tents of Jacob. It's very interesting to look at this phrase in light of the imprecatory prayers that we saw back in Ezra and Nehemiah. Nehemiah, when he prays the prayers, it's always in reference to the folks like Sanballat or Tobiah, who are opposed to the project of Israel rebuilding their walls. And I think more importantly, Israel as the kingdom of priests that Israel is sort of hoping their history will lead them to be. So to pray for God to cut people off, the places where people make imprecatory prayers, is when there is a particular insult to the project of the kingdom of priests. So he says here, "May the man who marries a daughter of a foreign god be cut off from the tents of Jacob." And I think he pauses sort of here because it's very emphatic in the writers of the Second Temple that being opposed to the project of Israel being a kingdom of priests is opposed to the purposes of God in general. So it's interesting that we have this short imprecatory prayer here, and that it's very similar thematically to the ones that we saw in Nehemiah. as I mentioned earlier, Jacob, I think, is used throughout Malachi as true Israel. Here, this is especially clear because he said, cut off from the tents of Jacob, everyone who awakes and answers and who presents an offering to the Yahweh of hosts. So there is Jacob or true Israel within the larger group of all Israel. And he's asking that the people who are not interested in the project of Israel being a kingdom of priests be cut off from the true Israel, that is Jacob. There's this phrase, everyone who awakes and answers, which is somewhat cryptic. The best suggestion I saw for this is the awaking and answering would be a part of the nomadic sort of style of life. You have to have people who are on watch. When you're going through the camp, there would be a certain, you know, shibboleth that people need to respond as you're walking through in order to know that there haven't been any infiltrators. So the most convincing description or explanation of this phrase that I could find is that that's what's happening, is you have these people who are awaking and answering as if they are a part of the tents of Jacob, but really they're imposters. That by marrying the daughter of a foreign god, these people are infiltrators into this camp. And what Malachi is specifically asking for is that those infiltrators be removed, even though they're ethnically and genealogically from Israelite stock. Okay, this is the final section we're going to look at today. This is 2:13 through 16. This is another thing you do. You cover the altar of Yahweh with tears, with weeping and with groaning, because he no longer regards the offering or accepts it with favor from your hand. Yet you say, for what reason? Because Yahweh has been a witness between you and the wife of your youth, against whom you have dealt treacherously, though she is your companion and your wife by covenant. But not one has done so who has a remnant of the Spirit. And what did that one do while he was seeking a godly offspring? Take heed then to your spirit, and let no one deal treacherously against the wife of your youth. For I hate divorce, says Yahweh, the God of Israel, and him who covers his garment with wrong, says Yahweh of hosts. So take heed to your spirit, that you do not deal treacherously. Okay, the English of that last section in particular is particularly convoluted. As I was looking at commentators, none of them will sort of spell out exactly how you would put this together. So I have not yet been able to articulate how to translate this in such a way that it reads smoothly. So I'm going to talk about the ideas that I think are what Malachi is talking about in this section. And then maybe at some future date, I will put together something that actually sort of reflects all of those ideas in a graceful written way. I was not able to do that before today. Okay, so there's another thing they do. They're covering the altar of Yahweh with tears, with weeping and with groaning, because he no longer regards their offering or accepts it with favor from their hand. So as we have seen, like his discussion with the priests, there is a curse on their blessings, right? They're expecting something to come about because of the way they are behaving, because they are doing these religious things, and yet nothing is happening. The table of God is to be despised. And they are saying, why isn't God doing anything? Because Yahweh has been a witness between you and the wife of your youth. Now, if you have read Proverbs, I believe, in particular, you will recognize that phrase from stuff that Solomon says, remember the wife of your youth. Before I really studied Malachi, I thought that just meant the wife that you married when you were young. So people will use it as an affectionate phrase to talk about, you know, before I understood what Malachi is talking about, before I understood what I think this phrase is getting at, I would say, I don't know how often I said it, but I could be capable of saying, I would have been capable of saying, Aaron is the wife of my youth. My dad said that about my mom all the time. You are the wife of my youth, which is this sort of endearing thing to say, if that's if that's what the phrase meant. However, I think because of the way Malachi talks about it here, and because of the context in which Solomon is talking about this phrase, I think it has a different meaning. If you remember, one of the great problems with Solomon, and also with David, but way more problematic with Solomon, was that in order to form political alliances, Solomon would marry a lot of women who were not Israelites, so that he would marry, you know, an Ammonite wife, theoretically, so that the kingdom of Ammon would be, you know, at peace with him. And you could see him doing this with a Philistine princess, or with a, maybe there are some localities that he would not deign to marry somebody from that locality. But I think the sense of it is, because of these political marriages, he just ends up, he creates such great political alliances that he ends up marrying a lot of people. The wife of your youth then does not mean the wife that you married when you were young. I mean, I think it still has some of that sense, but it's the wife you married before you got into marrying for political reasons. So the wife of your youth is your Israelite wife. She is your first wife, who would have been an Israelite. So the treachery that he's talking about here is that God has seen that these people have not only married Israelite women, but they are also marrying daughters of a foreign god. Even though the wife of his youth was the person's companion and his wife by covenant. Okay. So this phrase, wife of your youth, is a very specific phrase. And I think that if you look at all the contexts where it gets used within Solomon, I don't remember if David uses the phrase, but if he does, I suspect that if you look at each of those instances, you will see that the wife of your youth is not the idea of sort of your first love, or the woman you married when you were younger. It's your Israelite wife before you started having political alliances. So using this phrase then from Solomonic and possibly Davidic literature, I don't remember if David specifically uses this phrase, Yahweh points out that they have dealt treacherously with that wife. So then we get this very convoluted phrase, but not one has done so who has a remnant of the spirit. I guess that's a sentence that makes sense. What are we talking about? Well, pay attention to this next sentence. And what did that one do while he was seeking a godly offspring? I think if you look at other translations of the English, this will be rendered more as if it is saying, what did God hope to gain by, you know, giving you this wife in marriage? He was seeking godly offspring. So if we think about the themes that were part of the whole issue of mixed marriages in Ezra in particular that we looked at, what we want from one of the things that we want from marriages is for the children who come out of those marriages to be handed the culture of their forefathers. And because these are the children coming out of Israel, God's hope is that those children will receive the same culture that their forefathers had. Now, I think that's the sort of idea surrounding this idea of the Spirit. It's not talking about the Holy Spirit. It's talking about in what is your approach? In what spirit are you doing the things you are doing? If you act treacherously toward the wife of your youth, then you do not have the same kind of spirit. And I do believe other translations will have remnant in the sense of the remnant of Israel. You do not have the same spirit as the remnant of Israel. So God was expecting you to have children who were godly. So pay attention to what your motives are here and let no one deal treacherously against the wife of your youth. For I hate divorce, says Yahweh, the God of Israel. And him who covers his garment with wrong, covering the garment. Garment here is probably a reference to underclothes. This is a sort of roundabout way of talking about sexual promiscuity. So don't be sexually wrong, and take heed of your spirit and do not deal treacherously. So in the end, what Yahweh is saying is, you are committed to the wife of your youth, your Israelite wife. But now you've gone and you've married another, at least another woman. You've married the daughter of a foreign god. In doing so, you have been treacherous. In doing so, you have not done what God wanted, which was in part having godly offspring. You have betrayed the values of Yahweh by passing on a culture that is not the culture that Yahweh instituted. I hate divorce, says Yahweh. He hates divorce, not in the sense that he doesn't want, he only wants one man and one woman to be married once, and then never again should a person leave that union and be married again. But rather, I think in this instance, what he's talking about is you have a man who is married to an Israelite woman, and then another woman who is the daughter of a foreign god. So the man is divorcing his wife by adulterating their relationship. He is taking on the religion of these foreign gods as a way to, like I discuss in Ezra and Nehemiah, as a way to get some insurance for himself. Yeah, it's great that I have Yahweh. I have a wife who's passing on the tradition of Yahweh. But, you know, there's other viewpoints out there. It would be good to have it'd be good to have Baal, you know, around just in case Yahweh, you know, doesn't quite have my back. So I think that's the sense of this passage. And I think that's why Yahweh is disgusted and is telling them to not deal treacherously. Okay, one final comment before we get to questions or comments that folks might have. There is a kind of divine logic to in the end. As we've seen, as we've been going through here, most of the time, the way that God clinches the argument is by saying, when we get to the end of time, this is going to be the case. You guys are offering me unworthy dead things. In the end of time, all of humanity is going to present themselves as an offering to me, from the rising to the setting of the sun, in all places. In the end, you priests who have not passed on this commandment, when you get to the judgment seat, you will see that I was the one who gave this commandment. So there's a kind of divine logic to this, because if you do not believe God, it is not a good argument. I remember David talking years ago. He was going through Exodus, and there's this moment where Moses is leaving Sinai to go to Egypt to get the people out. And God says, this will be the sign to you. You will come back to this mountain. And I remember David's commentary being, okay, great God. You know, if you're Moses and you don't believe God, why is God telling you something is going to happen, especially something so mundane, going to convince you that that's a sign from God? But when Moses came back, he must have had a moment of realization where he went, you know, God said that I would come back to this mountain, and I came back to this mountain. And I think the more that I look at the prophets and the more that I understand how God interacts with people, the more that God really leans into that way of doing things. The things that God offers as proof of why you should believe in him are not really proofs at all. They are the kind of thing where you already have to have some kind of trust in God in order for those things to feel momentous. Because if you're a priest and God says to you, when you get to the final judgment, you will know that I gave those commandments, the priests are going, well, but there's not a final judgment, so what does it matter? If you're the people offering these sort of half-hearted offerings, and God says, all people everywhere will offer themselves to me for all time and all places. And you're like, well, that's not going to happen. If your view of the world means that what's real is what's immediately in front of you and is the thing that you can understand right now and see with your eyes, you know, as Paul says, we walk by faith and not by sight. If you are living by sight, then when God says in the end, that is not a convincing argument. Why should I, like, I'm going to have to actually find out if this is true or not. It's not indubitable. You could be making all of this up. And yet I think that God is constantly asking people to believe him, and that the signs that he offers are not proofs in every case. Sometimes they are. Sometimes they're sort of unavoidable. But there is a kind of mindset that Jesus talked about, that even if you have, you know, Moses and Elijah, you will not believe someone who got resurrected from the dead. And so God is fond of giving signs that are not self-validating, that anyone who witnesses them must believe them. The Pharisees in Jesus' day saw what Jesus was doing and said, he's doing it by Satan, even though that doesn't make any sense. And I'm sure that in Malachi's day, it was very easy to blow Malachi off because God's not actually actively doing anything. God's not actually making rain fall from the sky. So this way that God interacts with humanity is very interesting. And I think it says a lot about God and how we need to trust him as we go through our lives. Because in the end, God is going to have the final say, and he is going to make the world according to his purposes. And if we believe that that's the case, then we will be a part of it. Okay. So I'm going to go to questions and comments now. Okay. Well, it looks like we don't have any questions about Malachi today. I was forwarded an email from Margaret about Ezra and Nehemiah, which, because we have a few minutes, I'm going to go ahead and answer. If I understood you correctly, Nehemiah 8:10, when it says, "The joy of the Lord is your strength," Nehemiah and company were telling the Jews to celebrate the feast and not weep or mourn, as they had started to do when the law was read, and they realized they had not been keeping it. They meant that the people should concentrate on Yahweh's patience with them and rejoice in that. Is that okay so far? I'd like to understand more about this. Do you think this is the same as what counselors mean by reframing? I often have a choice about how I view a situation and what aspect of it I concentrate on, though I may not realize it. A counselor might point out a benefit of something when I was stuck in freaking out about it. There are a number of things a counselor may hope to do by reframing: help the client to problem solve or to consider another possible interpretation of a situation. I'm wondering what Yahweh was doing here. I think it unlikely he is simply invoking the power of positive thinking. I'm wondering if Yahweh's purpose is what I think Paul is talking about in Philippians 3. At the beginning, Paul says, "Rejoice in the Lord." Then he talks about all these people who will try to get them to trust in the flesh, in which he has no confidence. Then he says he ignores or forgets what lies behind him and presses on toward the goal. Grieving our failure has its place, but it can have the effect of causing us to despair and give in to psychological and spiritual paralysis when we realize how helpless we are. We can lose sight of the mountains from whence my help comes. We can lose sight of Yahweh. I think it's possible that after hearing the law, the Jews were in danger of either despair, if they realized they couldn't do it, or legalism, if they gave in to the temptation to trust themselves and redefine righteousness such that they could. And Yahweh wanted to pull their eyes off themselves and up to himself, reminding them of his faithfulness and promises in them, his people. What do you think? I think that a lot of what Margaret is saying here makes sense. In the message where I talked about Ezra, about this section of Nehemiah, I think I was trying to emphasize a particular frame, as she called it, that I think I have a problem with focusing on. So she's talking about reframing. So I think there are three frames that each have their place and are expected at different times from believers. The first frame is our awareness of our own sin. We could call this contrition. The second frame is our awareness of the patience of God. We could call this hope. I don't really have a better word for it because this is kind of the new concept that I was wrestling with as I tried to put this, idea together for Nehemiah. And then the third frame is our awareness of being forgiven. And I think, for instance, the author of Hebrews talks about going with boldness. And I think is a lot of what people mean when they talk about joy. I think that it's very easy for me to try to go from the awareness of my sin, to go from contrition to I'm forgiven. I want to sort of get out of this state of realizing my badness and getting to being able to get on with my life. But I think that the thing that I was encountering as I was looking at the text of Nehemiah 8 was that there's this real emphasis on just sitting with how patient God is. And I think the reason that that is particularly evident in Nehemiah 8 is because they are celebrating Rosh Hashanah, which I think commemorates the incident of the golden calf. So the incident of the golden calf, I would think, would lead you to feel contrition, would lead you to think, oh, I am so sinful. But what Nehemiah and company say is, don't grieve. The joy of the Lord is your strength. So whatever they're supposed to commemorate about the incident of the golden calf, it's not, I'm such a terrible sinner. What they're supposed to commemorate is that God doesn't immediately smite them, right? And this is the thing that other author, you know, Paul talks about how you, don't you realize that God is so patient with you that you might come to repentance? And I think it's just very easy, even within a Christian frame of mind, without getting into sort of legalism or without even getting into like depression, or despair of how terrible I am. I think that there's a tendency to try to go from one to three, from contrition, oh, I'm a terrible sinner, to I'm forgiven. But Ezra does not do that. Nehemiah does not do that. Both of them have instances where people have this long period, Ezra's prayer comes to mind, where they just dwell on how God is patient. If you remember from Ezra 9, Ezra does not ask for prayer, does not ask for forgiveness in his prayer. He just says, it'd be so understandable why you would want to crush us, but you haven't. And I think the remarkable fact of God's patience is the thing that Ezra and Nehemiah particularly were emphasizing, that I was noticing, that I think I have not done a good job of making time to be in that frame of being okay with God being patient with me and recognizing what that says about God. I want to go from I'm a terrible sinner because it's fun to wallow, and I am forgiven because it's fun to get on with your life. But I think that there's this middle thing that you need to live in sometimes, which is God is so patient with you. And I think that's distinct from those other two things. And I think it's important. And I think that's what Nehemiah and crew are talking about in Nehemiah 8. All right, folks, we have one more week. I will finish Malachi next week. And I hope it's fruitful for you all. Thank you for your time and attention. And I'll see you next week.